Well, we've just concluded a week of eating unleavened bread, and I don't know how it is with everybody else, but I have not yet eaten any leaven, and that's not because I'm extra righteous, just because we don't eat a lot of bread in our house. Kathy doesn't eat bread, and so therefore, and I typically avoid it, so we're still working on, I think, a half a box of matzos that we still haven't finished. So it is nice to know, though, I don't have to worry about thinking about whatever, you know, if there's a restaurant or something somebody wants to go to, I don't have to think, is there something on the menu that is unleavened, you know, that I can get? Or remembering not to get the croutons in the salad or eat the bread that comes with a meal sometimes. But we've been hearing a lot about leavening and unleavened bread. And hopefully as we were eating the unleavened bread, we were thinking, and I know that many of the messages we heard did focus our minds on thinking about the physical act of eating unleavened bread, which would tie us to the spiritual side of getting rid of sin, of putting sin out and putting something good in us, which was Jesus Christ. As we've heard, Jesus Christ called himself the bread from heaven in John 6, and that's been covered pretty extensively this season. His acceptance by God the Father as our perfect offering was foreshadowed for us in so many scriptures that we will see today in the Old Testament, in something that many people today call types. Some people can like to refer to these as similar to the icons that we see on our computers, and that may be something more relevant to the younger people here, is that you typically have in your computers or your phones, your tablets, various icons that represent an application, that represent something that you want to do an activity in. And so the Bible gives us something similar to that, and it gives us pictures of Jesus Christ and of what he would later do when he came to this earth. There was a special offering that I do want to cover today called the wave sheaf offering, which I don't think has been discussed at this time yet, this year, but I do want to talk about it today, and I want to go into some information before we get to that discussion, so hopefully we'll understand a little bit more of what was happening in this offering, the pictures that it gives us of Jesus Christ. Let's look at some background material, and these are some of the offerings that God instructed Israel to bring in the book of Leviticus. They're described for us, if you want to just jot this down and maybe go look at it later. The chapters of Leviticus 1 to Leviticus 5 give us these offerings. And these were given to Israel in the wilderness, and this was after the tabernacle had been erected. And these were offerings that brought the people of Israel into fellowship with God, into fellowship with him in the tabernacle. I'm going to be quoting today from a book that I know that I've talked about before by a gentleman named Andrew Jukes, and its title is The Law of the Offerings. If you want a really deep dive into this, I would recommend looking at that book, but we're not going to try to cover all of that. That would be way too much material. But I do want to kind of try to hopefully give you an overview and an idea of some of the things he presents. In the offerings, we're given multiple views of Jesus Christ. And he fulfills all of these views, all of these types, as we'll call them, in what he did in his life. Not only in the way that he was offered and sacrificed for our sins, but also in the way that he lived his life. That was also an offering to God. The first three offerings that we see discussed in Leviticus are what are termed the burnt offering is one, which was an animal that was presented. The other is a meal or a meat offering, if you have a King James Version, which was fruit of the ground, which was grain or some other type of a presentation of fruit from the ground. And the third one was a peace offering. All of these Leviticus describes as a sweet aroma, something that was pleasing to God. The burnt offering was a type or a picture of the worshiper coming before God and wholly surrendering his life into God's hands. We see Christ represented as that, as the way he lived his life. In the burnt offering, we see Christ as a human being in his lifetime offering to God the something that was most precious in his eyes. That was surrendering his life, his time, his energy to God the Father in everything he did. Ephesians 5:2, Paul kind of refers to this. If you want to turn over to Ephesians 5:2, we'll just read this very quickly. Ephesians 5:2, Paul is, I think, thinking about this offering as he describes Jesus Christ to the Ephesians. Ephesians 5:2, we're breaking into the introduction here, or the thought of this chapter. And Paul writes, "And walk in love, as Christ also has loved us, and given himself for us, an offering and a sacrifice to God for a sweet-smelling aroma." So here we see Paul referring to this type of offering that Leviticus calls a sweet-smelling aroma, something that was pleasing to God, something that brought the worshiper into fellowship with God, and was a type of the worshiper giving everything to God. Now we see the sin offering, as later described in Leviticus, was not called a sweet-smelling aroma. So the verse that, or the thought that Paul is giving us here, is talking about those first three offerings. Let's go back and just turn to Leviticus chapter 1, and we'll just kind of summarize this burnt offering. Leviticus chapter 1, and in verses 1 through 5, we see the description of this. We see that they could bring, it was an offering from it could be anything from a goat to a sheep to a cow. And the offerer would bring it to the tabernacle, and it says, "He shall offer it of his own free will." And the offerer was to put his hand on the head of the burnt offering, and then I think that in the description of this, it's a little bit confusing, or can be, because in verse 5 it says, "He shall kill the bull." So most people think that the actual offerer, the man or woman, well, the person bringing the offering was the one that killed the animal. And then the priest would bring the blood from that and sprinkle it around the altar. But it was not a sacrifice that was for forgiveness of sin. It was something to be offered of your own free will. It was not required. And speaking of this, Jukes writes this about this offering. He says here that this offering was to satisfy a holy and loving requirement. It was not to satisfy offended justice. The burnt offering is the satisfaction which God receives from the perfectness which the offerer presents to him. So it was something that showed the perfectness of the offerer to God. It involved the offering of a life, something that from the beginning God claimed as his own. So here in these offerings is a picture or an icon presented to us of what we owe God, our duty to Him, and the offering of the body of Jesus Christ is seen as fulfilling that duty to God, perfectly keeping the first four commandments of the ten. The offering was wholly burnt. The animal was taken after being slaughtered and wholly burnt up on the altar. This showing us the relationship to God that we all have committed to as baptized members of the church. That our relationship with God does not involve just putting one part of our life under God, but a complete surrender of everything in our lives to Him. Now let's quickly go on to the meal or meat offering, the grain offering. Here we see a picture or a description of man fulfilling his duty to his fellow man. And the reason they talk about that in this offering is that part of the worshiper would bring this offering. Many times it was either parched kernels of corn or grain, or it was ground up flour with a little oil mixed in with it. And the priest would take a portion of the offering and burn it on the altar. But the rest of that offering belonged to the priest and his family. And they were fed from that grain offering. They ate of that grain offering. So we see here that man was fed, or a duty was performed to feed your fellow man through this offering. The ingredients encompassed, like I said, flour, oil, and frankincense. And each one of these brings out a detail of how Christ fulfilled this sacrifice. God's allotment to mankind from the very beginning were the fruits of the earth. If you want to note, jot down Genesis 1:29 as a reference, and I'll read it. And God said, "I have given you every herb that yields seed, which is on the face of all the earth, and every tree whose fruit yields seed, to you it shall be for food." So this was man's allotment, but life was reserved to God. Even after the flood, when God allowed mankind to eat the flesh of animals, His instruction still was, "The life which is the blood, you shall not eat." That's in Genesis 9, verse 4. The importance of this difference that we see between the burnt offering and the meal offering is this. God claimed life as His. And in the burnt offering, it represented what man owes to God. Man owes his life to God. The fruit of the earth is given to man and represents what we owe to our fellow man. The gift of this grain offering represents the fulfillment of our duty to our neighbor. God tells us in Leviticus 23, "You shall love your neighbor as yourself." The idea presented is that a man is surrendering himself to God as a sweet aroma so that he may give his fellow man his due. So that is something we see Christ doing in His life. So many times the world around us, they focus only on the sin offering aspect of what Christ did. And they don't focus on these aspects of what Christ's life fulfilled in these offerings. One of the last offerings that Leviticus talks about is the sin offering. And here's what Jukes writes about this offering, and I think it's very poignant what he says here. Breaking into his thoughts on the sin offering, he says, "But here, in the sin and trespass offerings, we read of sin in connection with the offering. Here is confessed sin, judged sin, sin requiring sacrifice and blood shedding. Yet, sin atoned for, blotted out, and pardoned. The sin offering shows that sin has been judged, and that therefore the sense of sin, if we believe, need not shake our sense of safety. Sin is indeed here preeminently shown to be exceedingly sinful, exceedingly hateful, exceedingly evil before God. Yet it is also shown to have been perfectly met by sacrifice, perfectly born, perfectly judged, and perfectly atoned for. That is the picture, that is the story that we see given to us by the sin offering. With that information now, let's go look at the offering given for the wave sheaf. This would have been done, and this year we're actually in a similar week pattern as what happened when Christ was sacrificed and killed, when he was crucified. And so this offering would have been presented Sunday morning of this week and would have begun our count toward Pentecost. So today we are on day 7 of our count of counting 50 days toward Pentecost. Let's go to Leviticus 23:10, and we'll read about this offering. Leviticus 23:10. Speak to the children of Israel and say to them, when you come into the land which I give to you and reap its harvest, then you shall bring a sheaf of the first fruits of your harvest to the priest. He shall wave the sheaf before the Lord to be accepted on your behalf. On the day after the Sabbath, the priest shall wave it. And you shall offer on that day when you wave the sheaf a male lamb of the first year without blemish. And notice the type. A male lamb without blemish as a burnt offering to the Lord. Its grain offering shall be 2/10 of an ephah of fine flour mixed with oil, an offering made by fire to the Lord for a sweet aroma. And its drink offering shall be of wine, 1/4 of a hin. Notice here we don't have any mention of a sin offering being presented. All we see is a burnt offering and a grain offering. Both of these, as we just heard, were types pointing to Jesus Christ's sacrifice. The burnt offering represented Christ satisfying God's requirements, wholly consumed by fire, while the grain offering represented Christ satisfying man's claim on his fellow man, as only part of it was burned and the rest eaten by the Levites. There was no necessity for a sin offering in this ceremony, as the wave sheaf represented Christ in perfection being presented to God, being brought before God. Let's continue on. Leviticus 23:14. You shall eat neither bread nor parched grain nor fresh grain until the same day you have brought an offering to your God. It shall be a statute forever throughout your generations and all your dwellings. And you shall count for yourselves from the day after the Sabbath, from the day that you brought the sheaf of the wave offering, 7 Sabbaths shall be completed. So we see here the connection that God makes between the spring holy days, the very first spring holy days, to the next season of holy days that we will, or holy day we will celebrate on Pentecost. Count 50 days to the day after the 7th Sabbath, and you shall offer a new grain offering to the Lord. This wave sheaf, as I said, pictures Jesus Christ being presented to God, the resurrected Jesus Christ coming before God. And I brought this out in another message I gave, and I'd like to just make this point here that as Paul writes to the Corinthians, in 1 Corinthians 15, he tells them, if Christ is not resurrected, you are still in your sins. Your faith is empty. So that fact that Christ walked out of that tomb is a central tenet of our faith in Jesus Christ and God the Father. Christ was the antitype or the fulfillment of this wave sheaf. In Colossians 1:18, he is called the firstborn from the dead. And in 1 Corinthians 15:20, he's referred to as the firstfruits of those who have fallen asleep. But so many times when I would think about and read about this wave sheaf offering, and I don't know if you all have the same thought in your head that I had, When I read about this, I always thought, okay, so they took a bundle of grain out of the field, and they tied it into a bundle, and they took that and they waved it in the temple. And that's the way I always pictured it, was, okay, it's just some stalks of grain tied together, and they bring that and wave it before God. And that's actually not what happens. It starts that way. It starts as grain on a stalk, but it actually goes through a process of preparation to be presented to God, which also, I believe, points us toward what Jesus Christ endured. This word sheaf in Leviticus is actually translated from the Hebrew word omer. An omer is equivalent to about 2 quarts of barley flour. So any of you who bake and make things, you know that 2 quarts is a good amount of flour. But here is what happened to prepare that omer, or that wave sheaf. It was to be cut at a specific time of day. Since the Sadducees were in control of the temple, the sickle was put to the grain that they were going to use for this offering right at sundown on the weekly Sabbath. So this would have been correlated to the time that Christ was actually being resurrected, on that Saturday, late afternoon, evening. That barley then was used to prepare for the offering the next morning. Let's look at a quote. I want to read a quote here from the book, The Temple, Its Ministry and Services. And they describe real in some detail what the process was for getting this grain. Quoting from this book, "When the time for the cutting the sheaf had arrived, just as the sun went down, 3 men, each with a sickle and basket, would formally set to work. In order to clearly bring out all that was distinctive in the ceremony, they first asked the bystanders 3 times each of these questions. Has the sun gone down with this sickle into this basket on this Sabbath? And lastly, shall I reap?" I'm sure the answer to all those questions was yes. They would cut down barley to the amount of 1 ephah, or 10 omers, which is equal to about 3 pecks and 3 pints of our English measure, which I don't know what a peck is, but I guess you could go Google that and look that up. Though 1 ephah, or 10 omers of barley, was cut down, only 1 omer of flour was offered in the temple. That's the end of the quote from the book. So here we see they went out and they harvested barley. The grain that they harvested was then roasted and ground into a fine flour to be presented as the omer, or the sheaf, the next morning at around 9 a.m. Even this preparation, as I said, is full of types pointing to Christ, as he endured a fiery trial at the hands of not only the Jewish people, but then the Roman soldiers, who beat him and then crucified him. We see the picture of his suffering by the grinding of the grain as it's ground into small pieces of flour. That morning, Christ talks to Mary, and he tells her that he needed to ascend to his Father. Let's go to John 20 and verse 17 and read this. John 20 and verse 17. Jesus said to her, "Do not cling to me, for I have not yet ascended to my Father. But go to my brethren and say to them, I am ascending to my Father and your Father, and to my God and your God." So Christ had not yet ascended to be accepted on our behalf. Christ is the true bread from heaven, fulfilled the types in this offering, as he presented himself before the Father, as the omer to be lifted up, fine flour, unleavened and perfect. We see that Christ even compared himself to manna. If we go to John 6, and I'll just kind of summarize, because I know we have heard a lot of John 6. this time of year, I think almost every message we've heard has mentioned John 6. But in there, Christ talks to the audience, and he tells them, I'm the bread of life. I'm the manna, the real manna, not the physical manna that your fathers ate in the wilderness, but I'm the real bread, the true bread. And if we go back to Exodus 16, we can kind of read how he's referring back to this original event of what happened to the Israelites. And the story, the context of this is they had been complaining. They started to complain about not having enough food. And even Moses doubted, right? Even Moses says to God, how are we going to feed all these people? We're out here in the middle of the desert. Where are we going to get all the food? And God says to him, do you think my arm is short that I can't do this, that I cannot provide food? And then he goes on to bring them quail. Exodus 16, beginning in verse 12, he brings a bunch of quail and feeds them meat. And then he tells them in the morning, you're going to have bread. And they must have been thinking, wow, what kind of bakery is God going to set up to make bread for everybody? God had a different idea. When the dew lifted off the ground, they had bread. They had manna. As they said, what's this? Is the Hebrew word for this word manna. And if we go down to verse 16, we read, this is the thing which the Lord has commanded. Let every man gather. Again, this is Exodus 16:16. Let every man gather it according to each one's need. One omer. Notice that. One omer for each person. According to the number of persons, let every man take for those who are in his tent. I find it interesting that we see Christ describe himself as the bread of life. He compares himself to true manna that provides true life. And when we go back to Exodus 16, we see that when they gathered it, an omer was sufficient for each person. And what was in the wave sheaf offering? The type presented to us is an omer. An omer of barley flour raised up before God, symbolizing again that Christ's sacrifice was sufficient to satisfy God, to atone for the sins of this world. He's presented to God as the first fruits from the dead, the first omer of a mighty harvest yet to come at the return of Christ. We've been called now to become part of that early spring harvest. The season of a grain harvest was a metaphor that Christ used in his preaching. There were two major seasons of harvest in Israel. There was the grain harvest in the spring, which started with barley and ended with wheat. And it took place between Passover and Pentecost. Pentecost, as we know, is also called the Feast of the First Fruits because the season begins and ends with an offering from the first fruit harvest. We had the barley offered at the beginning with the wave sheaf, and then we have wheat offered at the end on Pentecost. Christ uses this as an analogy of what he was doing on this earth. If you want to jot this down, Matthew 9 and 35 through 38, Christ is out and he sees the multitudes of people. And everywhere he went, multitudes followed him. Many times, not for the right reasons, as he pointed out to some, you're just coming here because I fed you bread. But many came to be healed, came to be taught. And it says in this passage, he looked out and he said, the harvest is truly plentiful, but the laborers are few. And he ends this passage in verse 38. Pray the Lord of the harvest to send out laborers into his harvest. So he describes this period of time as a harvest. You and I are part of that harvest that God is gathering now. We are part of the spring harvest, the early harvest, the harvest of the first fruits. The wave sheaf was the first of those to be gathered. Christ was presented once to God, and once that was done, that the barley harvest began. Again, we see here another picture that God gives us, a picture of the perfect offering that was given to God for you and me, for the entire world. And it identifies the counting point, the start of the count toward Pentecost. So with this, we see God connecting Passover and unleavened bread to the next holy day of Pentecost. And they were instructed to count, as we read. They were to count 50 days. And at the end of that count, they did bring another offering. And it's interesting, the offering they brought on Pentecost was an offering that contained leaven. Two leavened loaves were brought and waved before God. They were not put onto the altar because they were not allowed to be put there because of the leavening. But many, and I believe it's true, see this as a type of the Church of God. The Church of God that has leaven. Yes, we still have sin, even though we've come under the sacrifice of Jesus Christ. We still have leaven. And we are waved before God, presented to God on the Feast of Pentecost. The Jews refer to this time period that we are in now as counting the Omer. And they actually track the days. They track what day of the count they're on. They feel it is intended to focus their minds and focus their attention on the laws of God as they approach the day that they feel the Ten Commandments were presented on the Feast of Pentecost. In this way, they're ever mindful of the coming holy day. And I know there are some, and I think Kathy does get an email where there's a gentleman down in Florida that writes a little commentary on each day, and he calls it Count 50, and each day he sends an email with what day of the count it is and a commentary on a passage in the Old Testament, which is during this time period. For us today, God is reminding us his plan does not stop with the redemption of sin through Christ's sacrifice. Our deliverance from spiritual Egypt and the removal of sin from our lives, but that must continue. That must continue to the next holy day, which pictures the pouring out of God's Spirit. God's purpose for his people, God's purpose for you and me, cannot be completed without this essential ingredient. God's command to count toward the next holy day is designed to direct our minds to pay attention to what is coming, to pay attention to the next step in God's plan. God is focused, as I said, on a harvest, on the spring harvest that includes all of us. From the Pentecost that was celebrated by the early church in Jerusalem to the day that Christ's feet touched the Mount of Olives at his return, Christ and the Father have been focused on gathering that early harvest. As we come into this period of focusing on what Christ's offering means for each of us, we must be mindful of the work that Christ is doing in our lives today so that we can be included in that spring harvest. God instituted this wave sheaf offering to point our minds toward the perfect offering that would be presented by Jesus Christ to God the Father. And that this offering, as Hebrews tell us, presented once and once for all, was enough to cover all sins ever committed.